is a very positive stance.
So I think some people most probably were watching the news this morning and saw that a lot was flooded out and the airport was totally flooded, so they figured they can't make it to the shir this morning. But
you too.
But you know, this is not a lot. This is just Yerushalayim, you know. A lot, it's a lot of rain 5 days a year. The only thing is it all comes down in a day and a half. So, all right. Last week, simply because I was taking a peek at Parshat HaShavua, and Parshat Mishpatim ranks one of the three parshiot that really garbles up the majority of the 613 mitzvot. So you know, you have all these Parshiot HaShavua, you know, at least 50 to go right the way we split the Torah. And yet the split of mitzvah, of mitzvot, is so unbalanced. I mean, Sefer Breshit, practically, are there any mitzvot? According to Sefer Chinuch, he squeezes out three. But then, you know, it starts moving in Shmot and Vayikra and so on. You get the three parshiot, Mishpatim and Shmot, Kedoshim and Vayikra, and Ki Tetzei and Dvarim.
And
Re'eh is a lot of mitzvot, but it doesn't come close even to Ki Tetzei. Ki Tetzei is the winner, by the way, gold medal. Has the most mitzvot of any of the parshiot, and Mishpatim doesn't lag far behind. So much of Mishnah and Gemara relate to these three parshiot in the Chumash: Mishpatim, Kedoshim, and Ki Tetzei. So we have we focused on Basar B'Chalav, right? Lo Tvashel Gedi B'Chalev Imo. I pointed out in sources 1 and 2, same pasuk except two different locations. One was Parshat Mishpatim, Shmot Kav Gimel. One was Parshat Ki Tisa. We're going to get to it just in a few weeks. The same pasuk, Reishit Bikurei Adnatcha, Tavi Beit Hashem Elokecha, Lo Tvashel Gedi B'Chalev Imo. We have a mitzvah of bringing Bikurim to the Beit HaMikdash, the first fruits of the seven species. Do not cook the meat of a goat in its mother's milk. That's loosely translated. Of course, the halachic translation is we shall not cook essentially kosher meat, meat from a kosher animal, in milk from a kosher animal source. That's number one. Number two, we're not allowed to eat the cooked product of basar b'chalav. And number three, we're not allowed to derive benefit, financial or otherwise, from the cooked product of basar b'chalav. This is important because if it's not a cooked product, then the prohibition of eating meat and milk at the same meal is not a biblical offense. We talked about this last week. Chachamim slapped on a rabbinic restriction that we should separate between the basar and chalav, meat and milk, in our meals. I mentioned that, at least that one counting, when I was teaching down in Bar Sheva, I counted 9 different views of how long you have to wait. The most was 24 hours, mentioned in the Gemara, but as I said, it's never made it to the annals of Halakha. But what we do know, most of us are familiar with a 6-hour view, and some are familiar with a 1-hour view, and some are familiar with something in between, some variation of a 3-hour view. What I don't like is, and I've heard this from some B'nai Torah, they'll say 3 hours, the German Jewish minhag, that's amaratzis, it's ignorance. That's not true. Anybody that makes such a statement is an ignoramus. Is an ignoramus. While it's true, there's no 3 or 4 hour view mentioned in Shulchan Aruch. That I would agree to. But that doesn't make it into a shita view that's based on ignorance. Quite the contrary. If you see the first volume of the 8-volume series of Rav Professor Daniel Sperva on Minagei Yisrael, so he has a whole chapter on how Minagim sometimes develop as a compromise stance between two extremes. So last week I mentioned this, but I didn't illustrate it with other examples so we get a clear case, clear example and description of what this means. When you put up a mezuzah in your house, so I'm sure you're familiar with the fact that the mezuzah is a little bit slanty. It's a little bit slanty. Some people, the mezuzah is quite correct, except the head is slanty. That's, that's a different story. But there are two views as to how to put up a mezuzah by a door. One is vertical and one is horizontal. Mu'nach and mu'uzan. Vertical or horizontal. I have never seen a horizontal mezuzah. Never seen it. Never seen it. But the view exists. Perfectly vertical, I've seen it also. I've seen it. There are some Sfaradim who are makpid that this is the view. This is the in the machloket between the vertical and horizontal. The halacha is like the vertical. And there are those who simply put up a mezuzah in a very vertical way. But what developed in many Ashkenazi communities was to accept the viewpoint that it's vertical, but to take into consideration the other view. Now, how can you have vertical and horizontal at the same time? It's not going to work. So by having it inclined slightly, and when I say slightly, I don't mean 45 degree angle. That's too slight. But just slightly, you know, moved over, what we're doing is we're showing that there's another view in town. That's all. Fundamentally, we're putting it according to the view of the vertical. But we're taking into consideration that there's another shita, there's another view that says horizontal, and that's why we're putting it on somewhat of an incline, just a few degrees incline. So this, Rav Rebbe points out, this is an example of a minhag that was designed by compromise. I'll give you one more example. Kol Nidre. So the original Kol Nidre that was found in the days of the Geonim in the 9th and 10th century, days of Rav Hai Gaon, one of the greatest of the Geonim in Bavel. Bavel then, the yeshivos were in Baghdad, as a matter of fact. So this was a type of Hatarat Nedarim. Hatarat Nedarim means you made a vow during the year, and for whatever reason, you feel that you're not going to keep your word about this vow. And when I say a vow, it doesn't mean just some a promise to do something, you know, to give you something. That's not a vow. It's still a word, and a word is also something that should not be taken lightly. Although a word cannot create a acquisition, a kinyan. If a person says, "I'm going to give you a gift," and then a person changes his mind, so the other fellow cannot, you know, take you to a Beit Din and say, "Hey, you promised to give me a gift." It's not going to work. There has to be some formal acquisition, kinyan, and different modes of kinyan that the halacha entertains. It's certainly not amira. It's just saying it. You're allowed to, saying does create these types of obligations. When it comes to hekdesh, if you want to donate to Beit HaMikdash, so you're not going to ask Kadosh Baruch Hu to, you know, sign the contract with you. So you there's no formal kinyan, because with a Kadosh Baruch Hu, you can't do a formal kinyan. So there, your word is basically that which creates the obligation. Or to use the Gemara's expression, amira legavoha kemesirato lehedyot, that just saying something to the above is like giving something, mesirah, a formal giving, to a normal person. Okay, so sometimes word is important. But even on a human level, the Torah says, lo yachil dvaro, don't profane your words. You said something, keep your word. It is important. And we had a prime minister, Yitzhak Shamir, who fundamentally was an erlicha, no scandals around Yitzhak Shamir. There were positive things about his tenure as prime minister and some things that were left to be desired. But once there was a political deal that was made, and he didn't keep his part of the deal. So they said, Hiftachta, you know, you promised. Okay, niftachti, below niftachti likayem. Niftachti, you know, I promised. I didn't promise to fulfill it. It's something else. Funny, but it's not so funny. If a person promises, a person should. But that's should go follow through. But that's not a neder. A neder or a shvu'ah, those are two different things. Neder and shvu'ah. Neder is where you use Hashem's name by creating a personalized prohibition. As if, you know, 365 don'ts in the listing of the 613 mitzvot are not enough for you. You think you need another one. And it's not for Klal Yisrael. If somebody gets up and says Klal Yisrael has to keep another one, that's Baal Tosif, that you're not allowed to do. But you take upon yourself an extra. Why might you do that? It could be any one of many, very personal reasons, including the fact the person just went to the doctor. And doctor said, look, you just have to cut out the, you know, sugar. What do you mean cut out sugar? You know, thick shake is a basic staple, you know, and I got to cut out sugar. So the doctor is warning you, if you don't cut out sugar, you're going to get, you know, serious diabetes, going to this and that and this and that. You better do it. The man takes him seriously. But the fact that the doctor said it is not good enough. He wants to somehow add weight to the fact that he's not going to eat things with sugar. So he takes a neder. He says, with the name of Hashem, that he's not going to eat foods with sugar. Now, if he touches something with sugar, he's not looking at the doctor anymore. He's looking at HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that he takes very seriously. So what's the difference between neder and shvuah? They seem to be the same thing. A neder is where you've created a prohibition on an object. You say, for 24 hours, I'm not going to drink Coca-Cola. As a neder. So for you, just for you, 24 hours, Coca-Cola became treif, became chazer, became pig, pork, meat. That's what it is. You've created something that essentially is kosher, but you've made it into something non-kosher. So why aren't you drinking the Coca-Cola? Because in this 24 hours, it's Pesach Chazir. That's why I'm not doing it. Just like I don't eat chazer, I'm not drinking Coca-Cola. What's a shvuah? Shvuah says, no, the Coca-Cola remains kosher. So it's kosher with the two Ashkechot from the Rabbanut in Tel Aviv and Rav Landau in Bnei Brak. Still kosher. Except that I'm going to distance myself from the bottle of Coca-Cola. Now, in both scenarios, it's the same result. You're not drinking the Coca-Cola. As it was, the neder happens to be a stronger form because you've now halachically created a prohibition on an object, whereas in a shvuah situation, you did not do that. The object remains as is, except that you voluntarily distance yourself from it, you pull back. So why does the Torah have neder and shvuah? Let's have one or the other. Why we have both? You're going to have to ask a Kadosh Baruch Hu why we have both. But there are two mesichtot in Mishnah and Gemara, Masechet Shvuot and Masechet Nedarim, that speak about the differences between whether it's a neder or shvuah. So they're not the same. They're qualitatively not the same. The implications are not the same. The ramifications are not the same. And in one sentence, in the beginning of Masechet Nedarim, the Gemara tells us, you know really what the fundamental difference is? And you could swear that this is straight out of the Rav's grandfather, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik from Brisk. The difference between a gavra and a cheftza. A gavra means, from the word in Aramaic, gavra means a gever, person. It doesn't mean a male. It means a person, a human being. A subjective call. And chefetz, from the word cheftza, chefetz means an object. It's an objective call. So he says that, the Gemara says that in neder, the prohibition is on the chefetz. And in shvuah, the prohibition is on the gavra, on the person. That's the fundamental difference. What Rav Chaim from Brisk did, he took that those categories that the Gemara uses once in all the 2,500 pages of Shas, and then expands it to other things. And all of a sudden, we start analyzing, let's say, Chametz on Pesach. So Chametz on Pesach, which is obviously biblical, is it that Chametz is really okay on Pesach, except the Torah says we should distance ourselves from the Chametz? Or has the chametz become, as an object, off limits? So the answer is obvious. It becomes treif, right? It's obvious. Chametz on Pesach is asur. The object itself becomes asur. Yet Chachamim then extend this to Erev Pesach, and they say that in the morning hours, we should also not eat chametz any longer. Whereas from a biblical point of view, noontime, chatzot, is when chametz becomes off limits. Because it's linked to the offering of the Korban Pesach. It happens to be the pasuk right before Reshit Bikureyat Matzah. Lo tizbach hametz dam zevchi. Lo tizbach hametz dam zevchi. So the explanation is, don't slaughter the Korban Pesach while there's still chametz around. That's basically the halachic understanding. And whereas we're permitted to offer the Korban Pesach from noontime on, from there we learn that from noontime on Erev Pesach, chametz is off limits. But it's chametz. But what did Chachamim do? They moved it up a few hours so that we don't trespass the biblical line, and now we have a rabbinic line. So the rabbinic line, you look at a calendar, you know, in round numbers it's going to be 10 in the morning, but it might be, you know, 9:46, whatever it is, each year it's different. And then, of course, this year we have Shon Kayetz. So whatever it is, you look at the calendar, you see, when is the Sov Zman Achilat Chametz? When is the, yeah, summertime's coming around in less than a month. Parshat Vayakel Pekudei is already summertime. So, right. The chametz in the morning, it's not really chametz yet. The Chachamim didn't come along and say, oh, now rabbinically we're making it chametz. What they did was they said, distance yourself from the chametz. Now, you may say, it's the same thing. It happens not to be the same thing because there are ramifications how you define it, whether the chametz became real bona fide chametz even on a rabbinic level, or chametz remained kosher throughout the year, same thing at 10 in the morning on Erev Pesach, except that at 10 o'clock, Am Yisrael won't eat it any longer. Okay? Beseder. So you have these distinctions with Neder and Shvuah and other areas as well. Yavaksha.
What's the ramifications if a person says, I promise, or if he says, Beli Neder?
Okay, so by saying Beli Neder, what we're really saying is we're excusing ourselves from the parasha of Nedarim. We don't want to slip by accident into a scenario where we said something and it could be construed as a bona fide Neder, even if you didn't mention Hashem's name specifically. But sometimes the way the neder is formulated, the implication is that you want a Kadosh Baruch Hu to go along with it. So if a person, you know, gets used to saying bli neder, so even if you promise to do something, you don't do it, you can sleep well that night, okay? That's really what the bli neder is. So this brings back to the point that I'm bringing up. What is Kol Nidre? So Rav Hai Gaon says that Kol Nidre is Hatarat Nedarim, on a very, very public level. Very public level. You don't have anybody standing up and itemizing any particular vows that he or she made during the year. Chazan gets up there and is draped by two people, which seems to constitute a Beit Din. And he says all the various expressions of Nidarim, which includes Nidrei, which is Nidarim. It includes Shvuei, which is Shvuot. But other things, konamot, kol nidrei, ve'esarei, ve'kinuyei, ve'kinusei. We know this from the nigun, from the kol nidrei. But these are just different expressions of vows that the Gemara Masechet Nedarim operates with. So the kol nidrei nusach says any of them. If you said any of them, lashririn v'la kayamin, it should have no validity whatsoever. The original version was from last Yom Kippur to this Yom Kippur. Miyom Kippurim she'avar, ad Yom Kippurim zeh. In the past year, if somebody said something, made a neder, so, and you didn't do private hatarat nedarim, which happens to be a minhag on Erev Rosh Hashanah, so to do private hatarat nedarim, but a person didn't. So the community is covered with the communal kol nidre of the chazan on the night of Yom Kippur. Comes Rabbeinu Tam, this is 12th century, Rashi's grandson. He says, you can't do this. This is not hatarat nedarim. It's not, you can't do it on a wholesale, you know, way. Like everybody's standing there and the chazan gets up there. It's not going to work. It doesn't work. Halachically, it doesn't work. So, but Rabbeinu Tam was smart enough to know that after being in the Machzor Yom Kippur for 400 years, he can't push the delete button. He can't do that any longer because Kol Nidre has already made it in both the Sephardi and Ashkenazi communities. It's here to stay. So what does he do? Cosmetic surgery. He makes a time change. He says, all right, we'll have the Kol Nidre, but it's not really a Tarat Nedarim, but it's a Bli Neder for the next year. One big, loud Bli Neder. Miyom Kippurim Zeh Ad Yom Kippurim Haba Aleinu Letova. From today, Yom Kippur, until next year, Yom Kippur, Kol Nidre Ve'esare Ve'kinuye Ve'kinuse Yushvuye. Okay, lo shririn v'lo kayamin, have no validity. Which basically means that if you didn't say Bli Neder during the year, you were covered by Kol Nidre, the past Yom Kippur. That's really what Rabbeinu Tam did. He negates, he took all the air out of the balloon of Hatarat Nedarim from Kol Nidre. He says, no, it's not Hatarat Nedarim at all. But it's something else. But the Chazanim were happy because it just made a slight wording change and that didn't affect the Nigin, the Nusach. Right? Fine. So you have these two nuscha'ot, two versions of Kol Nidre. What happens as time rolls on and as here we come to Eretz Yisrael and there's this movement of merger of nuscha'ot, open up a Rinat Yisrael Machzor Yom Kippur, which is used by many, many here in Eretz Yisrael. What does it say? Miyom Kippurim She'avar Ad Yom Kippurim Zeh Umiyom Kippurim ze ad Yom Kippurim haba aleinu l'tova. That wrecks havoc in the niggun for the chazan, because he was never trained to have that kind of elongated Miyom Kippurim. It's either this or that. So he's got to fake it a little bit and stretch it a little bit so that it should fit into the niggun, the traditional niggun of Kol Nidre. Now, would Rav Haigon be happy with this? Would Rabbeinu Tam be happy with this? Neither of them would be happy with this. But as Rav Sperber points out, we do this. Why? We've made peace with both views. And this is the compromise that we've introduced into Kol Nidre. By not taking a stand on the machloket, the dispute between Rav Haigon and Rabbeinu Tam, we do both. We do both. It's almost like putting the mezuzah in a diagonal, you know, slanty way. And there are many others, but I must confess, it was the first time that I really began to appreciate where the 3 hours between meat and milk came from. Because Rav Sperber points out that the 6 hours was already known in North Africa and in the Sephardi community. Not only Rambam has it, but before the Rambam, 3 generations before, the Rif, Rabbi Yitzhak Lafasi, he's got the 6 hours already. And the Sephardim are observing 6 hours. It's difficult to know whether they're holding 6 full hours, or as we talked about last week, those who have 5.5 or 5:31, which means the majority of the 6th hour, and some have 5:01, a minute into the 6th hour. All those are 3 different versions of 6 hours. Whatever your Zayda and your Bubba did, that's what you continue doing. I'm not here to change the rules. But that's the 6 hour. And what really gave a little bit freedom and flexibility to the exactness of the 6 hours is the Rambam uses the word kemo she'sha'ot. Kemo she'sha'ot means be'erach, around 6 hours. Now once you say something like that, you've opened up the Pandora's box for something less than. Of course it could be something more also, but nobody's going to take more than 6. But there's something less. It's also around it's very similar to the Rambam's half an hour for Hanukkah candles. Kimo chatzi sha'ah. Berach. I mean, the Rambam doesn't want you to stand there with a stopwatch. You know? Okay. You know, a berach, 6 hours. And that's what it is. So the berach, approximately 6 hours, generated these lenient views of the 6 hours. 5:01, 5:31, whatever it is. It's berach. It's kimo she'sha'ah. And then there were 2 different explanations. So why 6 hours? Because the Gemara doesn't say 6 hours. The Gemara says between meal and meal. Misuda to suda. So then some introduced the issue of digestion. And some introduced the idea that there's still meat stuck in the teeth. We talked about this last week, that the Rambam didn't know from dental floss and stymie dents. So there was and it was undigested food stuck in the teeth. And therefore, if that gets loosened, and now you're having something chalavi, milchik, so you're going to have meat and milk in your mouth at the same time. So and the figuring was that after 6 hours, the digestive juices in the saliva have already done a chemical job on whatever might be stuck in the tooth, so it does not have a status of bisharit. Yeah, Rivka.
If there had been Eretz Yisrael, or somebody, you would have been Meir, who's telling you that in the 3 hours, Eretz Yisrael.
Yehuda Meir, the famous Yehuda Meir, I know Yehuda Meir. Look, Yehuda Meir is a Muslim from the Rav. He's one of our boys. I beg to differ.
Okay.
There's no
What's
such
the question?
The question was, is there a Minhag Eretz Yisrael on the question of the waiting time, and specifically 3 hours? You know, if you grew up in Kibbutz Tirat Tzvi, you might believe it. The reason is because many of the 1936 kibbutzim are people. I tell you something. So my family, we know a little bit about Yekis. My father-in-law, Zechon Lebracha, was from Frankfurt. My mother-in-law, Tibadel Or Chaim Tovim, also from a town near Worms called Aish. We know about Yekis, and my father was born in Berlin, even though we're not Yekis. But that was a stark accident. But it was. Between World War I, World War II, there was a migration of Polish Jewry to Western Europe. So I call this a historic accident, that's all. We're not, but we knew, we know the German, you know, Minhagim and so on. There is a word in the language, the English language, that does not translate into German. It's called change. German Jews are wonderful people, and we love them dearly, but they don't know how to change. I attributed my in-laws' long life to that. Change. They have difficulty changing. They really do. You know, you're set in a certain way. Some people enjoy variety. You're right, you go to a restaurant. So many people spend 15 minutes on the menu. Okay, why? Because you want to see, and to try something new. Try something new. But I know people who don't even look at the menu because they've been at that restaurant and they already order. Because they can order the exact same thing they ordered last time before because it was good. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. Don't get me wrong. But you play it safe like that. You knew you liked it last time. If you're going to take something different, you know, you may not like it. You know, but those are two different personality types. There are certain people, when they drive, they only go a particular route, right? I'm not like them. My wife knows that I'm not like that at all. If I see a new road open up, you know, take it. Just let's see where it leads to. So fine, once in a while you get what's called a blunder, and you have to turn around. Okay, but you've learned. You see a new road, a new street, a new bridge, a new tunnel, epic something. And it's, to me, it's very, very exciting. Right? A Boeing 787. It's new. Right? It's these things, you have a new airport. These things are very, very exciting to people who enjoy variety. But not everybody enjoys variety. So, for people in Germany, to leave Germany in the 30s and to come to Eretz Yisrael, the situation in Germany must have been already very bad. And it was bad. My father grew up in that, in the 30s. My father left in 39. Mm-hmm. Berlin. Pretty late. As late as you can get. A few years ago, my wife was on an international conference in audiology in Europe. So, you know, you sit around the table, you know, sometimes you schmooze. So there were some audiologists and speech therapists from Germany. They're talking, but sadly, you know, you talk to people. And there's some small talk, and have you ever visited Germany? So my wife said, no, my parents were from Germany. Oh, well, when did they still live there? No, they left. When did they leave? 1938. That was the end of the conversation. That was the end of the conversation of being nice. You know, 1938. All right. So the situation must have been very bad. But the Mesirut Nefesh of coming to places like the Emek Beit Shan and they had to deal with malaria and draining the swamps. This is not, you know, Donald Trump draining the swamps of Washington. This was mamish swamps. And people got sick and they died. In order to have the land blossom. It's tremendous. All of these. And they did it. And they did it. So if you grew up in that environment, and you know, the kibbutz life was a very, very closed environment. And of course, the minhagim were from the old home. So you thought everybody in Eretz Yisrael kept 3 hours, because in Tiferes Tzvi, everybody keeps 3 hours. Okay, that can happen. So I'm not familiar where you'd have been here, you grew up. But there's no minhag Eretz Yisrael, because all the Sephardim, they never heard of it until they came to Eretz Yisrael. And the Tunisian community, this I learned when I was in Be'er Sheva, the Tunisian community had a minhag that after meat they waited 6 hours, but after chicken or turkey, oaf, they waited 4 hours. There was such a minhag of the Tunisian community, which is very much against the Rambam. The Rambam says 6 hours, whether it's meat or oaf. He says clearly, whether it's meat or oaf, it's 6 hours. But a minhag is a minhag. And the Tunisians, but the Moroccans didn't have. The Jewish community of Morocco kept 6 hours, whether it was meat or whether it was oaf and so on. So Shperva says that the what happened was there were two views in town, in Europe. And the first view, the main view, was Rabbeinu Tam, who said you have to separate the meals with a formal Birkat HaMazon. We mentioned this already last week. With a Bracha Achrona, you say you bench, you finished your meal, and now you can go right on to your next meal of the different of the gender, from Bisari to Chalavi. But in the 13th century, when the Zohar appeared, and there in Parshat Mishpatim, it talks about waiting an hour in both directions, between meat and milk and milk and meat, so it became upgraded. Ashkenazi Jewry adopted this opinion of the Zohar. It could be it was from the influence of what we call the Hasidei Ashkenaz, not to be confused at all with modern Hasidic movement of Baal Shem Tov. I'm talking about the 13th century, Rabbi Yehuda Hasid and others, Sefer HaChasidim. There was a movement of extraordinarily great tzaddikim who took upon themselves a lot of extras. Some of the extras became mainstream, some of the extras just you know, just, you know, phase themselves out with time. I will even mention one that I'm sure some of you are familiar with, and that is that if somebody is on the shidduch market, I don't know if that's a proper word, but he's looking for a nice shidduch, and he meets up with this nice young lady whose name is Rachel. Uh-oh, your mother's name is Rachel. We got a problem here, right? Where does it say in the Rambam or Shulchan Aruch that that's a problem? It doesn't say anywhere in any halachic sefer of Middle Ages that's a problem. Rabbi Yehuda Hasid left a will, a tzava'ah, to his own children. Willed his own children that they should not marry women who carry the same name as their own mother. What was the chumrah all about? You have to realize that in those days, the young couple would usually move into the family, the parents' house. And in days where there was no electricity and everything was dark, and the young couple, the young husband would call out for his Rachel, and who knows, maybe the wrong Rachel might show up. That, it's a way out chashash, it's a way out thing. But you have to realize, when these artificially concocted chumras are put together, they have a basis on even a way out level. But it was never ever intended that this should become mainstream. Yet, in certain circles, it became mainstream to the extent that either a shidduch will not be made if this happens, or a name change. Right? They'll say that the kala, the future kala, should do a shinui shem and add a name. Her name's Rachel, but now she's Chaya Rezel Rachel. Right? We'll add a few newer names to it, so the Rachel gets a little bit camouflaged as a second or third name. So that's already somebody. That's not an issue. And there are people who really care about this. Now, what about the flip side? A girl marrying a guy who has the same name as her father. Rabbi Yehuda Hasid never ever said anything about that, because even this way out chashash is non-existent in the case of the men. Yet that didn't stop the author of the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Shlomo Ganzfried from Hungary, to saying it's the same thing in the other way. Yeah. What do you mean the same thing the other way? It doesn't. There's no reason. Absolutely no reason. So you see how a chumrah takes on its own dynamics and then starts developing, you know, in its own way. So you have the days of the 13th century, people waiting an hour. In all of Ashkenaz, we're talking about Germany and Eastern Europe, Poland, where they have Polish Jewish communities, Hungary. And the Rama in the 16th century in Shulchan Aruch says clearly, you wait an hour between meat and milk. But, he says, we have to upgrade. It's a good thing to upgrade to 6. He recommends it. He recommends to move to 6 hours. And I mentioned last week that his granddaughter marries the Shach, Rabbi Shabtai Kohen, who says if you have Reach Torah, if you smell from Torah fragrance, you should really be waiting 6 hours. So that means it took a few generations, and there's a campaign, an active campaign going on Eastern European soil to upgrade. And eventually, it catches. So the Polish Jewish community, the Russian Jewish community, the Hungarian Jewish community keep 6 hours. But when that movement starts encroaching on Germany, you know, change. What do you mean 6 hours? We wait 1 hour. But apparently the onslaught was so great that the Rabbanim or others, they could not simply dismiss it. So the dust settled and there was a compromise. And that was the 3 hours. I mentioned last week that in Hamburg it was 4 hours, Frankfurt was 3 hours, and then there was survival of the fittest. The three overcame the four. So the German Jewish community, Minhag, became three. It became three as a compromise between the 6 and the 1. And this, what I call now the tornado effect, never hit Holland. And that's why the Dutch Jewish community just kept what they were doing. It's not that it's a Dutch Minhag. It was the old Ashkenazi Minhag that was never tampered with. That's where the 1 hour of the Dutch Jewish community was all about. So today we're going to deal with what the title of the shiur, Nekudah Niflaah, the wonderful point. And I mentioned that the Rambam, occasionally, when he makes a point about something that's methodological or very, very central, it's relevant to the subject at hand, but it most probably is relevant to so many other subjects that the Rambam feels to draw, he draws our attention to this, and he says, pay careful attention to what I'm going to say now, because it's going to impact on other things as well. So, for openers, we have discussed time and again the numerical factor of Tariag, 613, of 248 pluses, the positives, and 365 don'ts. Yet we don't have a tradition as to what are the 248 and 365 that led to all kinds of disputes. From the days of the Mishnah, the first time a listing is put together is in the 7th century, the author of the Halakhot Gedolot. Rambam challenges it big time, and Ramban challenges the Rambam. And then you have the Sefer Mitzvot Gadol, Sefer Mitzvot Katan, and Sefer Yireyim. There's a whole literature out there just called Binyan HaMitzvot, the counting of the Mitzvot. So with regard to Basar V'Chalav, so we said that three psukim, and the Gemara says three psukim, the same pasuk, Lo Tvashel Gidi V'Chalev Yimo, to teach us that there's a prohibition just to cook the cooked product of meat and milk. There's a prohibition to eat the cooked product of meat and milk, and a prohibition to derive benefit from the cooked product of meat and milk. So okay, so how many slots of the 613, let's say of the 365 don'ts, are we going to use now? So it's logical to suggest either one or three. One, there's an issa basav v'chalav, and that comes into component parts. You learn the details, you see the details. But the Torah talks about basav v'chalav, it takes up one space. Mm-hmm. And indeed, there's some that believe that. Or you might argue, the Torah speaks about it in three different locations. So perhaps the Torah is trying to teach us it's three different averot. That also makes sense. So we have others who counted three times. So of course, if that happens, then those counters are going to have to account for this somewhere down the road so that they get to the 365 at the end of the day, so they get the 613 at the end of the day. Fine. That's already the intellectual gymnastics that they're going to have to work out. But with regard to Basar V'Chalav, it's either one or three. The one who really throws in a monkey wrench is the Rambam. He counts two. Two? Why two? So he says one is the Bishul, because that is really a strange thing. There's no such thing as prohibition of cooking pork, meat, or anything like that. No prohibition whatsoever. You're not to eat it, that's all. So, hey, I have something special. Lo tevashel gedi. But he says with regard to eating and deriving benefit, those two are first cousins. They're first cousins. What does that mean? Eating is also a hana'an, is a benefit. It's just an example of a benefit. There are other examples of benefits. Financial. You can sell it, right? You make money off it. You might find favor in somebody's eye by giving somebody a gift. So you're not making any money, but let's assume you have a cleaning lady who's not Jewish, and you want to and you happen to have something that's particularly not kosher, but that person certainly allowed to, you know, eat it, and it could be even an expensive item. But all right, why throw it in the garbage? You know, that person has his or her, let's say, her holidays. You want to give it to her as a holiday gift? That's perfectly okay. And there's a lot of good feeling that's created. That's called a hana'ah. That's called a hana'ah. But there's also psychological hana'ah, which I remember when we were studying Masechet Pesachim with the Rav. So in the second parak of Masechet Pesachim, in the Talmud Yerushalmi, it says on the pasuk lo ye'achel chametz. Not only does it say lo tochal chametz, but the Torah once says lo ye'achel. Ye'achel means chametz should not be eaten. Should not be eaten. That doesn't necessarily mean you. It could be don't create a scenario that chametz gets eaten by somebody else. So the Talmud Yerushalmi says even if you're feeding ofot shel hefker, pigeons in the park. Do you have an obligation to feed pigeons in the park? So if you have a pet, a domesticated pet at home that you have to feed, let's say you have a dog or a cat or goldfish in the aquarium, you know, that you have there. So fine, so on Pesach, you're obligated to feed them. You bought these animals and you took upon yourself to feed them. So you better make sure you don't give them chametz, because it's not that you're eating chametz, but you're getting hana'ah. Financial hana'ah. You can't say, all right, I have a few extra breadcrumbs here, so I'll use it to feed the fish during Chol HaMoed. You can't do that. You're going to save money on buying, you know, kosher lePesach, fish food. So you're going to use some extra breadcrumbs. Why throw it out? You know, breadcrumbs, chaval on the few agarot. Fine, I'm just using an example now, just so you can understand. That's not a psychological hana'ah. That's a financial hana'ah, where you're saving money by using the breadcrumbs. But if you like to sit in the park, and you come with a little bag of breadcrumbs, and you just enjoy throwing some bread particles on the ground and watch the pigeons come, it's a beautiful thing to see, by the way. You see a Kadosh Baruch Hu's, you know, briot, and you see that they eat and how they eat, and then eventually, you know, they're not scared of you because they realize that you're a friend, and they'll even come a little close to you. I mean, too close, not, but they won't fly away. You know, if you just jump, they see you're giving them food. Do you owe those birds anything? Absolutely not. So what? Where's the hana'ah? The hana'ah is a psychological. It's a good feeling. You give yourself a good feeling by using the chametz. So that's also asur. That's also prohibited on Pesach. Lo ye'achel chametz afilu ofot shel hefker. So we see from there that there are all different types of hana'ot. But one of the classic hana'ah that a person gets from something is food. You eat it. You enjoy it. It's an enjoyment in the food process. And you should know that if a person eats something that's not kosher in a way where the person could not possibly have enjoyed it, then biblically speaking, the person did not violate eating treif. I'll give an example. But let's assume you have meat that's very much not kosher. Very much not kosher. But it's spoiled meat. Now, forget about the, you know, the health considerations here. But it's spoiled, it stinks, it's this and that. And you ate it! You ate it. So, you know, you might be a little bit crazy for having eaten it, but that's a different sugya, that's a different parsha. But in terms of eating non-kosher, you did not violate eating non-kosher. Because to violate eating non-kosher, you have to enjoy it. It has to be something that's edible for human consumption. So if it's burning, blazing hot, and you gulp it down, and you burnt your tongue in the process and really didn't taste the food because it was so blazingly hot, scalding hot, you also did not violate a problem of eating. And for example, why does every Rav in town know that on Yom Kippur you can take a pill? Forget about the cup of water with it. That's a different parsha. But some people are capable of taking, you know, pills without water. They can gulp it down. So why is that not eating on Yom Kippur? That person is considered a faster 100%. He can get an aliyah, he can be the chazan for Nila, everything. He's no limitations whatsoever. He did not break his fast. Why didn't he break his fast? He gulped down two pills because the pills are bitter and he did not get any enjoyment in that gulp. So therefore, it was not derech achilato. That's not the way people eat. And so too, by the way, if you happen to hook yourself up to intravenous on Yom Kippur, and you simply have fluids enter your system, and fluids can also have some extras that can give you some nutrition to the bargain, you did not violate the fasting on Yom Kippur. That's not called breaking the fast on Yom Kippur. I have a tradition from the late Chief Rabbi of Be'er Sheva, Rav Elio Katz, Zichron Lebracha. Don't ever tell anybody to do that on Yom Kippur. You know why? He wasn't worried about the quote-unquote eating on Yom Kippur through intravenous. He felt that even if the needle was prepared before Yom Kippur, the fact that you're going to be hooking something up, inevitably the needle sometimes moves a little bit and can cause a wound to the extent that that's an Issa Dohaita. You've been mechalel Yom Kippur by expanding the wound. The needle was put in on Erev Yom Kippur, and you put a lot of tape around it that it shouldn't move. But it doesn't always sit well, and when connecting it to the IV, it could move, and you can even draw blood. If you draw blood, even a drop, you're mechalel Yom Kippur. He said, it's not worth it. It's not worth it. So he said, he told me, you know, remember, never to tell anybody to do something like that. The Shaila came up because we had both doctors, in Mashul and Yang Yisrael and Be'er Sheva, and she was pregnant, and she decided that's what she was going to do on Yom Kippur. And I brought the question to Rav Katz, and he told me what he told me, and she did what she wanted anyway. She told me up front that you can ask the rabbi whatever you want, but this is what she's doing. So, Baksha.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm getting the impression that I can eat treif as long as I don't enjoy.
I didn't say that. I'm very happy you made that point. I'm really, really happy you made that point. I did not say that as long as you don't enjoy it, you can eat treif. Didn't say that. I said that if a person eats something non-kosher in a way that there was no physical enjoyment, he did not violate the prohibition of the biblical prohibition. From that to say that you can do it is a long way to go. And I didn't say that. Obviously, you shouldn't do that at any cost. But if it happened, yeah. So what is the Nekudah Nifla'ah? The Nekudah Nifla'ah, the wonderful point that the Rambam makes here, and if you look at source number 5 in the Sefer HaMitzvot, in the second paragraph that's underlined, V'kan ra'ui li she'ermoz al shorish gadol shelo kadam li zichro. Here's the time that I'm going to spell out something that is very fundamental. Shorish means the root. It's a very fundamental point. And I don't think I talked about this previously, says the Rambam. So here I am. Let's talk about it now. And he goes through the business of the three violations from the biblical point of view, but why he only counts two. He counts two is because Hana'ah and Achilah are fundamentally the same. Achilah is a form of Hana'ah. It's an expression of Hana'ah, of enjoyment. True, once the Torah gave this additional factor called Isu Hana'ah, so the enjoyment factor becomes multiplied exponentially to other Hana'ot. But it includes eating as well. So if a person eats on a basar b'chalav, the cooked product of a basar b'chalav, so in essence, the person has two averis. Which two averis? He ate the cooked product, and he had hana'ah from the cooked product. So the Rambam says, you don't get two averot. That's one avera. You because by eating, you've derived benefit. And from there you see that deriving benefit is a corollary or subsidiary to what we call in halakhic language a toledah, to the eating. They're first cousins. They are linked together. And hence we should not count Isur Hana'ah as an independent place in the schedule of the 613. It's clearly biblical, no question about that, but it does not have a place. And he's developing company policy here. And if you take a look at source number 6 on the bottom, where it's Pirush HaMishnah of Masechet Kritut. And I'm going to turn to the second page where you see it's underlined, but we'll begin in the end of the third line where it says V'yesh. V'yesh b'dvarenu eile nekuda nifla'ah. And there is a wonderful point here. Na'ir aleha. I'm going to expand on this. I'm going to say something here. This is going to be the key for other things as well. Nosaf lemasheba mi diyuk ha'iyun, beyond what we may understand from this specific case. Vehi, and that is min hayadua shebasar b'chalav asur b'hana'ah. We know that basar b'chalav is forbidden to derive benefit. V'hachalav derech mashal mutar b'hana'ah. No, this doesn't mean chalav, it means chalev. Chalev means fat. Fat is just an independent isur. Certain fats of animals. There's shuman and there's chalev. Chalev is prohibited. Derech mashal is mutar b'hana'ah. You're not allowed to eat it. V'im b'bishel hechalav b'chalev. If a person cooked milk in meat fat, the type of meat fat that is prohibited, matam lo yachul isur basar b'chalav al isur chalev. The question is there a compound isur by also having a prohibition of eating certain prohibited fats, and now I'm cooking this prohibited fat with milk, and I have now an isur of basar b'chalav. So he says, on the bishul part, for sure, I'm going to have a compounded isur. But if I'm going to eat it, it's not going to happen. The Rambam uses the phrase Isur Kolel, Isur Musif. Isur Kolel means it's a prohibition that's encompassing. It encompasses other things together. Isur Musif means it's additional. It's not part of the basic. And the Rambam says, if you don't get this point right, you're going to mess up in many, many areas of why or how I classify mitzvot in the Sefer Mitzvot. So I'll give you an example. It's we're almost Pesach time, believe it or not. We read Parshat Shkalim already, so that means it's almost Pesach. Everybody knows that there's a mitzvah to remember Yitziat Mitzrayim, you know, once a day. Remember in America we used to have a thing called one a day multiple vitamin. Right? So once a day you're supposed to have. Now the truth is there's machloket, whether it's once a day or twice a day. Torah says it in Parshat Re'eh, should remember Yitzhak Mitzrayim on a daily basis. So we all remember the Mishnah Because it's found in the Haggadah Shel Pesach, after the story from Daybrak, Amar Ablozim Nazariah. So you have the drasha, Yimei Chayecha Hayamim, Ko Yimei Chayecha Halelot. That at night time you also have to have the wrenching of Yetziyat Mitzrayim. And that generates the idea that in the nighttime reading of Shema, we should include the mitzvah of tzitzis, which is the third parsha, which we ordinarily would say, forget about it. There's no mitzvah of tzitzis at nighttime, because it says, Ubitemoto, you should see the tzitzit. Nighttime without natural light, you don't see them. So there's an exemption of tzitzit. And if there's an exemption of tzitzit at nighttime, there's no reason to read that third parsha. But the third parsha encompasses the Yetziyat Mitzrayim. So we do read it, fine. So the whole machloket is whether you read it once or twice a day. Everybody agrees at least once a day. And the Rambam doesn't even count that as a mitzvah in the 613. In the halachot, in Mishnah Torah, of course it's there. But it's not in the 613. And everybody yells, Gevald, what happened to this mitzvah? Well, why isn't it there? It's not a machloket. It's not this machloket. It's the argument whether yes or no. Everybody says yes. Question is, once a day or twice a day? But once a day, for sure. It belongs there. So the Rav's great-grandfather, who he was named after, Rabbi Yosef Dov Baer, and I know I don't have a lot of time, but did I tell you the story how the Rav got his name, Yosef Baer? I mean, he's named after his great-grandfather, but it was a sipur. The Rav was the oldest grandson of Rav Chaim. The Rav was the first grandchild that Rav Chaim Soloveitchik from Brisk had. And he really wanted that the baby should carry the name of his father, who was the famous Rabbi Yosef Baer, Rosh Hashiva of Alojin, then became Rav of Brisk, the Beit HaLevi, the author of the Sefer Beis HaLevi. The thing was, there's an Ashkenazi minhag that the mother has the first rights to name the baby, the first baby. For sure, the first baby. So the Rav Chaim sends a telegram to Chasilovich and asks, it was to Pruzhan, but they were still in Pruzhan, and asks if she could be so kind and named the baby after his father, Yosef Dov Baer. Okay, I mean, he asked permission. Now, Rav Chaim, and this is a man who was an all-time tzaddik, not just a gaon, I don't have to give the credit, you know, the marks to Rav Chaim, but on the matseva of Rav Chaim, it begins with Rav Chesed. He was an ish chesed. And normally, when you talk about Rabbanim, you know, you talk about their greatness in Torah, in their darshanut, in their chidushim, and everything. Usually the first thing on the agenda isn't, you know, so much the chesed. The Rav once quoted Meir Bar Ilan, who there were a little bit mishpacha, who's the son of the Netziv. Rav Meir Bar Ilan, Berlin, and Rav Meir Bar Ilan told the Rav that he asked two people, what's the main position of, main job of the Rav, what's he supposed to do? So he turned to the Orach HaShulchan, Chil Mechel Epstein, and the author of the Orach HaShulchan said, it's a paskin and shaylus, to render halachic decisions. That's what the Rav's supposed to be doing. And he asked Rav Chaim from Brisk, and Rav Chaim says, to be Osek B'chesed. That's what the Rav's supposed to be doing. Everything else on the side. It's Osek B'chesed. So this is Rav Chaim. So Rav Chaim never saw himself ra'ui, fitting, to serve as a sandak at a brit. People wanted him to be the sandak, and he declined the honor. He says, no, you need somebody who's ra'ui, who's fitting. Can you imagine? And it wasn't false humility. He just felt, Zelo Bishvili, you know, give it to somebody else. But the Rav's mother, she wanted Rav Chaim to be the sandak. So here she gets this request from Rav Chaim, if she could be so kind to name the baby Yosef Dov Baer. And she writes back and she says, there's a price tag, that Rav Chaim's going to have to be the sandak. And if Rav Chaim agrees to be the sandak, then she'll agree. So she had him over the barrel. She really did. She was a Soloveitchik. I mean, even though she was a born Feinstein. First cousin to Rav Moshe Feinstein, by the way. A born Feinstein. But she was a Soloveitchik in every sense of the word. Because when they got married, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, the Rav's parents, they got married. So Rav Chaim sends a telegram to Pruzhan excusing her from the fast of Chatan V'Kala. You know, it's a minhag that the Chos and Kala fast on the day of the wedding. But Rav Chaim was of the opinion that a general chulsha, weakness, has descended upon this world, and especially women, and we can excuse them forever and ever from this fast day. So he sends a telegram to Pruzhan excusing her from the tzoim, from the fast day. She sends back a telegram, thank you very much for the psak, but in Pruzhan we also have paiskam. And she fasted, by the way. right? So, those of you, some of you may, my father remembered the Rebbetzin, Soloveitchik. I mean, she was a tough cookie. And wow, to respond to the future father-in-law, Rav Chaim from Brisk, like that. Tada Rabba, but you know, we also have Poiskim here. Who asked you? Like, you know, anybody ask you for a psak? It's terrific. So the Nekuda Nifla'ah, right. So the Nekuda Nifla'ah, so this is what the Reis HaLevi said. You know why the Rambam doesn't include the mitzvah of Zechirat Yetziat Mitzrayim? Because it's a subsidiary to the mitzvah of Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim on Seder night. That's there. That's for sure a mitzvah. Everybody understands the mitzvah on the night of the Seder to elaborate. And as a corollary, as an extension of that very mitzvah, it pans out to the whole year to make token mentioning of Yetziat Mitzrayim every single day. But it does not stand as an independent mitzvah. It's all part of the same mitzvah. So being as part of the same mitzvah, it's the same nekuda nifla'ah, same wonderful point. And does not stand independently. That's what the Beis HaLevi said. And we know this because of Reb Chaim from Brisk, the son who gives it over in his father's name. And then Reb Chaim says, and by the way, I have a different answer. And he thinks his answer is better, which is going to teach us something, that even if your father is your principal Rebbe, you're allowed to disagree. And you're allowed to even rise above if you think that this is correct thing to do. Because I remember the Ramban once said about the Rif. The Ramban is 200 years after Rabbi Yitzchak Lefasi, and he said, between me and the Rif, I'm a midget. And he's an anak, he's a giant. And I'm the midget on the shoulders of the anak. Nanas al gabei ha'anak. So the Rav said, what was he saying? Ramban was saying two things. I'm a midget. The Rif is a giant. But you know, when the midget stands on the shoulders of the giant, who sees further? The midget has a better field of vision. That's what the Ramban was saying. Okay, beside that, I'm a midget, I'm goonish. And then the Rav, in a very uncharacteristic autobiographical statement, said about himself as being the nanas al gabei, the anak of his grandfather, Rav Chaim. And I believe that the Rav really believed that Rav Chaim was such a towering figure, but he also believed that he saw further. I believe he believed that he saw further. He had a wider angle, you know, view of what Torah was all about. It had a lot to do with his general education and the fact that he was able to disseminate it in a way and into an audience that went way beyond anything Rav Chaim could have ever dreamt of in Brisk. That's for sure. Nevertheless, Rav Chaim. So what does Rav Chaim say? Rav Chaim says that the Rambam tells us that anything that is limited to a time framework and is not on the books as a mitzvah from the days of Moshe Rabbeinu into the days of Yemot HaMashiach inclusive is not a mitzvah of Taryag. Now you can have a mitzvah that's suspended because of a technical knockout. We have to bring a korban this morning. Oh, why didn't we bring a korban in this morning? Because there's no Beit HaMikdash. That doesn't mean the mitzvah is not on the books. Of course it's on the books. But there's a technicality here why we couldn't do it. That's all. But the mitzvah's there. So in that Mishnah, there's a machloket. What's the second opinion? Chachamim omrim, yemechayecha ha'olam hazeh, kol yemechayecha lavi limot ha'mashiach. Which means that according to Chachamim, when is this mitzvah of a daily reference to Yetziat Mitzrayim obligated? When? Only bizman hazeh, before Yemot HaMashiach, because it's only the Chachamim who explain kol yemechayecha as including Yemot HaMashiach. Why didn't the first opinion, it's the opinion of Ben Zoma, because he needs it to teach me something about nighttime. Kol yemechayecha halelot. He has yemechayecha hayamim, kol yemechayecha halelot. Chachamim say, no, yemechayecha olam hazeh. Once a day, according to Chachamim, you didn't read the third parasha of Shema at night. It was a once a day thing. But it's never going to end. Even the days of Yemot HaMashiach, we're still going to continue. Ben Zoma said, no, we read it twice a day, morning and night, but in days of Yom HaMashiach, we're not going to have this mitzvah anymore. You're not going to have this mitzvah anymore. So it's a limited mitzvah. It might be in effect for 3,000 years, but that's called limited. That's called limited. If it doesn't extend into Yom HaMashiach, ad vad bichlal, it does not have place in the Taryag. And this, that's a brilliant understanding, very different than his father, the Beis Halevi. And this, you know, carries into the whole discussion of why the Rambam didn't count Yeshuva Aretz. Did the Rambam believe that there were certain time frameworks where the mitzvah is just not on the books? If that is the case, then we understand why the Rambam did not include Yeshuva Aretz into the 613. Perhaps there are other reasons. We'll have to try to explore that as well. So we're going to do next week, because it's going to be the Wednesday before Purim, and it's actually the day before Tanit Esther, which is a mukdam this year. We're going to, the title of the shir, as I have it printed out already, is called Esther Min HaTorah Minayin. From where do we know about Esther from the Chumash? Of course, we're dealing with the mitzvot from the Chumash. So don't expect to see in Sefer Mitzvot of the Rambam something about Purim. But nevertheless, we're going to see something in the Rambam about Purim. And something that may have its roots in the Chumash itself. Esther Min HaTorah Minayin. So same time, same station. Next week. Thank you.